Hello, everyone, and welcome to Module 16 of Advanced Aromatherapy, Therapeutic Application of Essential Oils for Clarity, Health, and Happiness, with David Crow, titled Combining Essential Oils and Aromatherapy with Allopathic Treatments. This is your host, Colleen, at the Shift Network. Just a couple reminders, if you've called in and you need any technical assistance, press 5. If you're on the webcast, please type directly into the box. And that covers it for today. So let's a big welcome for David. Welcome, David.
Thank you again, Colleen, and welcome back to everybody all over the world. We are moving rapidly, week by week, through our six-month program. And thank you, everybody, for joining. Let's go ahead and start by reviewing some of the webcast questions and comments that came in. So you can click on the link for Module 16, and you will see the file for webcast questions from Module 15. And I hope that everybody has had a wonderful break and had good opportunity to study your monographs and study the course material and catch up if you are not able to attend live. And also that you have been doing some blending and experimenting a bit to see how things are going with the oils. And I see that we do have a very nice comment on the webcast that just came in, a testimonial that came in sometime during the week, I guess. And so I'm just going to go ahead and start with that one. And we'll go back to the file. Thank you so much for all the information you have given us. You are most welcome. I have started to diffuse frankincense during my meditation practice, and I can't believe the difference it makes. That's a very nice testimonial, and I hope that many of you have had the opportunity to also try some of the sacred scents that we have talked about. This goes on. I can let go and settle into a much deeper space more easily and quickly, and my meditations are more intentional and supportive. Grateful. Okay, good. This is exactly what my experience is with these fragrances and the effect on the olfactory system, and through the olfactory system, the effect on the limbic system, and through the limbic system, the effect on the neurological and the endocrine system. And so I believe that the plants and their fragrances can be very, very supportive of our meditation practice. And we do not have to work with a lot of meditation obstacles of restlessness and fatigue. Those will always be there, especially in longer retreats, but we can certainly reduce some of the agitation when we're first settling down, because the oils will calm the mind and the nervous system and allow us to get into a state of clarity more rapidly. And we can also then use some of the uplifting oils if we are getting tired, losing concentration, and so forth. But we've already covered that in quite a bit of detail, and I hope that people really can take some time and explore that a bit more. So this testimonial goes on to a question now. I want to ask about the use of flower essences. I'm curious how they compare to essential oils in supporting emotional well-being and vitality. Perhaps where you think flower essences can be more useful, or essential oils more useful in general. Specifically, I'm also thinking about them in terms of helping me deal with anxiety and nervousness around becoming a more public figure. I'm a fairly shy person and struggle with this in my career. Excellent questions. And first, I would like to reiterate what I talked about. I just mentioned last week there was a similar question about flower essences, and I pointed out that flower essences are on the completely opposite side of the spectrum in terms of concentration levels. Essential oils are highly concentrated botanical substances. We could actually put them at the very top of the concentration pyramid. You might remember that idea, or when I was first opening this course many months ago, I was talking about how concentrated they are, therefore we need high levels of education. And that's also why we're getting adverse reactions, and therefore the more concentrated the substance, the more education we need, the more potential benefit, the stronger they are, but the more potential dangers. Now, flower essences are in the homeopathic range. Flower essences are basically energetic substances made by infusing the life force of a flower into water, making an imprint in water of the life force of the flower using sunlight. That's the short definition of it. And so therefore, a flower essence is a homeopathic strength remedy. It has energetic qualities as opposed to physical qualities, whereas essential oils have molecular concentrated powers. Now, the benefits and the ways of using them, there are pros and cons. On the one hand, the benefits of using essential oils are because they're so highly concentrated, and that's also the disadvantage. And you know by now that a lot of what we spent the last several months talking about is dilution, dilution, dilution. And don't drink them, and don't put them directly on your skin, and put them in these carrier oils, and they're best for this in a diffuser and all of that. That's the primary disadvantage, because they are so concentrated they can cause real problems. Now, on the other hand, the flower essences, being homeopathic in strength and concentration, raise the obvious question of, well, what do they do and how do they work? So the most well-known of the flower essence products that's on the market would be the Bach flower remedies. And out of those, probably the most well-known now that it has been featured on Dr. Oz would be Rescue Remedy. So the benefit of the flower essences is their subtlety, and that means that they can be used very safely on children and the elderly and animals. And many people are actually skeptical of homeopathic preparations because you can't find any molecules in them, and the same with energetic preparations of flower essences. But one of the interesting things about concerns that people have about extremely subtle energetic remedies like this is that maybe they don't actually do anything and it might just be placebo effect. But we see that the placebo effect doesn't really hold so much for children and animals, infants and animals who don't even know what it is and aren't going to have a psychological relationship with it. And it seems that flower essences are indeed very helpful from evidence-based medicine for children and animals. So obviously something's going on, and there are some hypotheses about how these work in the energetic realm, but basically they are subtle. That's the short answer. Okay, so I hope that's a good start. It's a big topic. I could refer you for more information on this particular subject. My wife Sarah has good information and an entire course that she developed on flower essences that is available on the Floracopia website. And I want to mention also that she is writing a blog post. You might know the company Goop. Gwyneth Paltrow's company has a blog section, and Sarah has just submitted a blog post answering this in quite a bit of detail, including a full explanation. So she's actually the expert, and if you look at their website, that's going to be coming out in about a week or so, and that would be some further reference. Can they help you with anxiety? Yes, absolutely. That's one of the main things. One of the answers that I know that she frequently gives is that this basically works on the prana body. Okay, that's going to be the Ayurvedic description of the energetic body. That includes the acupuncture points. It includes the acupuncture meridians. It's the part of the body that is stimulated through a pranayama, the breath, and through qigong. So it's like the energetic body. And because the remedies are energetic, that's where their effect will primarily be seen. And so the way she describes it is that they're very good for the shen, for the spirit, because they're very subtle, and therefore they reach into the mental, emotional, and psychological states very nicely. Okay, so that's a short overview, but I also wanted to give a little personal experience that I had dealing with anxiety and nervousness about being a public figure. And this goes back to our conversation about using essential oils to help us learn something. And I've mentioned this several times. We had a whole section devoted to it where we studied some oils that support cognitive function like rosemary and lemon balm and so forth. And I mentioned that you can use fragrance as a mnemonic device, meaning that if you use a fragrance over and over again while you're studying, then it will help you imprint the information into your memory banks. And we actually had a wonderful testimonial from a student at Bastyr University who reported that their test scores had gone up 10% or more after they started using this particular method. Now, I'm mentioning this method because you can use essential oils and fragrance to retrain your emotional reactions as well. And in a certain way, we have talked about this repeatedly, but I want to articulate it more clearly to help people understand that this is actually one of the things that we are doing whenever we do aromatherapy, or whenever we are using herbal medicine, or whenever we are engaged in a regular meditation practice. We are actually training the nervous system to be in a particular state. And I made some comments about this, about how I would give a very long extended treatment in my last clinic involving massage and aromatherapy and steam and acupuncture and shiradhara and meditation, and at the end of this 3-hour treatment that people would be very, very deeply relaxed. And then I would tell people in their final 15 or 20 minutes of the acupuncture session, I would say, okay, now I want you to concentrate on the body sensations and memorize what this feels like. And then when they would come out of the treatment room, I would check with them and see how they felt, and they felt great. And I would then ask them a question. I would say, did those results come from external stimuli, or is it something that's internally created? Well, it's both, because the massage is external stimuli, and the acupuncture is external stimuli, and the aromatherapy is external stimuli, but ultimately, it's our own brain that's resetting itself, recalibrating everything, relaxing the nervous system, letting go of the tension and all of that. It's ultimately our own self that's doing it inwardly, our own physiology, our own nervous system. And the point of that is that if we know a particular state of well-being, we can recreate it simply through memory. And of course, we lose it through distraction, but we can recreate it by going back into what it feels like and reactivating those sensations. Now, that's the idea also behind using essential oils for enhanced cognitive function. And it is also the idea behind using essential oils to train yourself to be in a better emotional state. And so in a certain way, what we're doing when we get natural medical treatments is we are learning how to be in a more balanced, relaxed state. And if we do it over and over again, we will just naturally cultivate more awareness and more ability to stay in that state and return to that state more easily. Now, we can do the same thing with aromatherapy. That is part of the idea here with the essential oils, and I'll just share my brief story, and that is that there was a period of time when I recognized that, okay, my career is going to involve some public speaking, and I was very nervous about public speaking, even in small groups. If we were sitting around in a circle and people were sharing things, 10 or 15 people, I would feel very, very nervous and very anxious about it. And so I realized, well, this isn't going to work because I'm starting to get invitations to speak at these groups about these different topics with natural medicine. And so I got this invitation to speak one time at the Santa Monica Public Library to a fairly large group. And of course, it just terrified me to think about even doing it. And I decided, well, all right, I'm going to have to get over it. And so what I did was I picked an essential oil that I liked, that I knew had some anxiolytic effects, and that was neroli. And you know about neroli. At this point, you know that neroli is very nicely anxiolytic. We've studied it in the well-being section for women and also for pregnancy. We know that it is significantly anxiolytic. And so what I did was I combined the anxiolytic effects of the neroli oil with that piece of information I knew about retraining or concentrating on a particular piece of information to learn it. And so what I did then was I imprinted a certain practice with that particular oil. And what I did was I would take one or two drops and put them on my palms, a little direct palm inhalation of the orange blossom oil, and then I would sit down and I would visualize walking up onto the stage at the auditorium there at the Santa Monica Public Library and walking in front of this large group of 100 or 200 people and giving a presentation. And I trained myself to visualize that I was doing this in a state of complete comfort. And as a matter of fact, that it went beyond that, that I was actually looking forward to getting up on stage, that I couldn't wait to get up on stage. And I did that practice right before I went up on stage. I took a little direct palm inhalation of neroli and walked into the auditorium, and there was a large group waiting, and it was my first big presentation on stage. And I just remembered that meditation, that visualization over and over again that I had done, you know, for a month or two before that. And I decided, okay, well, this is it. Now I have to practice that visualization. I'm walking on stage, and I am not only not nervous, I am excited about getting up there. And, well, okay, it more or less worked. And there's been no holding back ever since then. So I hope that's helpful, because I believe that there's actually a lot of benefit that can come from using natural medicine and meditation and aromatherapy to help. So I hope that addresses your question. I hope it's practical. I hope that it works for you. And just keep in mind, there's lots of oils that you can choose from for doing this. I would suggest using one that is your favorite, but the neroli is very anxiolytic. Okay, let's go ahead, and I want to take a quick look here into the webcast questions from last week. There's a number of really good things. And all these topics, you know, the reason I take time with them is because they're all directly related to making something practical here. So let me just refer you back to the link for Module 16. And if you open up that set of files there, the menu, you'll see at the bottom webcast questions from Module 15 from last week. And just go ahead and open that up. Now, the first topic here is our little debate about vaccines, and this class is not to debate vaccines. And personally, I don't have actually a position about vaccines. Okay, so that removes a lot of the argument right there, because my position is that there are pros and cons. There are times where they definitely can be helpful and times where they're not so helpful, and it's a very individual thing. But somebody did post some articles saying that there's no links between immunization and autism, and I took exception with that on the last call because my experience is talking directly to parents, and I value what parents say directly to me about their experience as parents. And so my position on this is outlined here. I don't think the debate is over for the simple reason that there's always new vaccines coming out. And I don't think that the debate is actually all that neutral either, because there are studies, and I've listed some of these here, showing that there are links to autism. And so if one side says, well, this study says there's no link, and another study says there is, I don't think that the conversation is totally closed. And furthermore, there's a lot of studies that show that vaccines can be linked to many other things other than autism. For example, neurotoxic conditions such as learning disabilities and so forth. So that wasn't the purpose of my making those comments, you will remember, and this is why I put this here, is that I want to reiterate that the real issue is not vaccines or not vaccines, okay? It's not just about that debate. It's not just about that. It's what is happening to the brains of the children. And this is a much more complicated question because it goes beyond just this one vaccine. It goes into the question of how many vaccines are being given and at what age, earlier and earlier, and preservatives such as mercury and environmental toxicity and things that are being passed from the parents who are not healthy, who are drinking a lot of diet sodas and smoking, and all these other things in the diet and all this stuff. And so now what we see is this epidemic of ADHD, and the schools have turned into dispensaries for Ritalin, and, you know, it's a very, very complicated situation. And that's the point that I was trying to make, is that there is so much widespread neurotoxicity in immunological disturbance in children that this is what we have to take into consideration when we are doing aromatherapy, because children who have been affected from whatever, maybe it's bad diet, or maybe it is partly vaccines, and maybe it is partly vaccines and Ritalin and steroid inhalers for their asthma. That's the situation I'm pointing to here, is that those children are going to be high risk when it comes to exposing them to essential oils. Okay, that's the most important takeaway point here, is that if you are doing aromatherapy, be aware that so many kids now have neurotoxicity, learning disorders, immunological disorders, immunological sensitivities, and that's what we have to watch out for. Okay, there's some links there. You can check them all out. It's a big ongoing debate, okay, for the simple reason that more vaccines are always coming out on the market, so it's not a closed discussion. Okay, next question, is the chamomile listed as an ingredient in the recipe for skincare blend given under the information for cystus, the Roman or German variety? Now, either one can be used effectively. From the therapeutic standpoint, the Roman chamomile smells sweeter. The German chamomile has more anti-inflammatory compounds in general. Somebody mentions here that they can actually taste the flowers in the Bach flower essences, and that's great. You have very refined taste buds. Somebody else wanted to comment about the discussion about essential oils and seizures. Fennel and nutmeg also seem to be problematic. Yes, but again, what we're going to see is they're listed in some sources, not in others. That's one of our primary topics for today, is the complexities of knowing when essential oils are safe or not safe when people are on medications. And we've already opened up that discussion. It's a good discussion. But I'm going to also give some basic guidelines of how we can think about it. And so somebody also posted, and we already covered this, the main groups of oils, main families of compounds that are problematic for seizures. And I just put this here to remind us, because we are going to move into that topic today. And finally, the protocol for anosmia. Several people have asked about this, and there is actually another question about this, and let me just see here. Something just came in. Okay, that has more. I'm going to come back to the statement here, the question asking about anosmia and treatment of that with herbs and so forth. I'm going to come back to that. What I want to do now is just go ahead and answer that question again. Now, I have actually given the specific protocol, but I would have to review all the audios and the transcripts to be able to tell you exactly where it was that I gave it to you. I don't recall. And so I'll just give it to you again, and I'll mention anosmia, loss of sense of smell. Parosmia is basically distortion of the sense of smell. So it creates the sensation that people are smelling toxic, bad things around them when it's actually our own olfactory system that is creating the smell inside the brain. It's like tinnitus. There's nothing actually happening in the ears, but there's ringing Well, it's not actually ringing in the ears. It's ringing in our brain. And the same is true with olfactory hallucinations and distortions and so forth. There's nothing externally that's causing it, but what happens is that it's either created entirely within the nervous system, or the receptor sites are damaged or malfunctioning in such a way that we may smell something and it doesn't interpret it correctly. Okay, or we don't smell it at all. And there's a lot of different reasons why this can happen, but since several people have asked, I'll just go ahead and explain the system. And this is a system that I have recommended many times over the years, and I have heard back from people many times over the years also. And this is all just empirical evidence, okay? This is all just observation, anecdotal, testimonials, things like that. There's no double-blind, placebo-controlled study here. It's just I make suggestions, and I hear back from people. And I believe that there was actually one or two testimonials already that have happened in this class where people have already said, oh, yes, it's definitely helping. So what I have found is that there isn't any clear cause and effect between a particular oil and a particular person being able to regain their sense of smell. It's very individual, and it doesn't matter what the strength of the oil is. That's what I have found. And so I have given people really strong essential oils like rosemary that are extremely powerful, stimulating the olfactory sense, and people can't smell them. And on the other hand, people could take a very soft fragrance that's almost imperceptible on a perfume strip like sandalwood, and they could smell it. That would be one of the first ones to come back. So my suggestion has been get a range of oils based on fragrance intensity. And so what does that mean? Well, rosemary has a very high fragrance intensity. Cinnamon, spice oils, these have very high fragrance intensity. Vetiver has a soft, earthy, rooty kind of fragrance. It's not going to jump off the perfume strip at you. Sandalwood is even softer. Okay, and the flowers are somewhere in between. Okay, so my suggestion is take five or six different oils and group them, classify them, or line them up according to fragrance intensity, and then every day just rotate through them on a perfume strip. So every day you smell a little rosemary for a few minutes and then put it down. And then an hour or two later, smell a citrus for a couple of minutes and then put it down. And then a couple hours later, smell something really soft like sandalwood and then put it down. And then a couple hours later, smell something really sharp like cinnamon or oregano and then put it down. And don't, if you don't have a sense of smell, don't put the perfume strip directly to your nostrils and leave it there for 10 minutes because you could do more damage. I'm just saying, just breathe it very softly and see if you can perceive it. And if you don't perceive it, don't worry about it. Just go on to another one. And if you do that, what's going to happen is over time, it's going to start to stimulate the olfactory nerve endings with a whole palette, a whole range of different olfactory molecules. And it could be that that wakes you up. It wakes up the olfactory system. Okay. That is the short review on that. Now let's go ahead and we have a little review. I wanted to articulate things from our class last week, and that has to do with the topic of aromatherapy for pregnancy and children. So I organized material, made a few additional comments. Let's go ahead and open those up in Module 16. If you would open up the file Aromatherapy During Pregnancy and Childbirth. Just to review the basic protocols here, I didn't give you notes on that last week, but here they are. The first trimester, avoid the use of essential oils entirely, especially if there's been a history of miscarriages. This is my protocol, but my protocol is in agreement and derived from the protocols of many aromatherapy organizations and teachers. Okay, so this is the general consensus. Now, I will mention that there are many aromatherapists who don't follow this particular protocol either. I mean, the entire field is full of diverging opinions about what you can do. And what I'm telling you here is what I consider to be very safe and very conservative. It's generally agreed upon as being safe and conservative. And I will mention that there are some people that will be even more safe and conservative and not do anything at all during the 9 months of pregnancy. And then there are going to be some people that I consider actually dangerous, who are telling pregnant women to drink essential oils internally. I will make a public statement about that and say that I think that that's a very dangerous practice. So here we have the basic protocols according to the general consensus of many teachers. The first trimester, avoid the use of essential oils, especially if there's been a history of miscarriages. Now, this is what I put in here. You can use aromatic plants for tea. Ginger tea, mint, tulsi, chamomile, and lower dose and frequency are commonly used and safe. Okay, lots of pregnant women drink chamomile tea. It's okay. Lots of pregnant women drink a little tulsi. Lots of pregnant women drink a little ginger tea. And again, use some common sense here, okay? If you have a history of miscarriages, don't be making all kinds of strong concentrated ginger tea in some, you know, ginger essence extract and drink gallons of it. I mean, let's, you know, keep it on the reasonable side here too. Okay, now we move to second trimester. Occasional use of floral essential oils in the diffuser and highly concentrated and highly diluted, I mean, that's very important, highly diluted in the bath. Okay, so a couple drops of lavender on a bath during your second trimester, no problem. Okay, third trimester, non-toxic and safe oils in the diffuser and for massage. And as I mentioned, there's lots of conditions that women really appreciate getting a massage for. And the rules that I'm giving you are very, very conservative. There's a lot of women who get massage in their first trimester, okay? But I'm just going to suggest for aromatherapy purposes, it's generally considered safe during the later stages, and these are the oils. And I gave them to you last week. Here they are written down. Cardamom, both of the chamomiles, frankincense, geranium, ginger, neroli, patchouli, petitgrain, rose, and sandalwood. Now, that comprises a list of very safe oils. And this contrasts with a list of oils that would be considered not safe during pregnancy. And there are different groups of oils that I have seen. You know, different aromatherapists just have different ideas about all of this. That's another reason here why you see so many of these scientific studies that I am giving you is because there's a lot of different opinions about what oils do and so forth. And now, gradually, the field is becoming more mature, more information is coming out, and more consensus is starting to happen. Okay, now this is happening now as opposed to, you know, a couple hundred years ago in European herbology. That's when herbalists were starting to really classify information and organize monographs and so forth, but this is very new, and so therefore the information now is starting to come out in general consensus about certain things and now starting to emerge. And so here's a list of herbs that are considered toxic during pregnancy, childbirth, and breastfeeding. And that includes anise seed and basils, and you could put the tulsi in there too, okay, the holy basil. But you'll notice that when I mentioned it, that I'm mentioning it as far as an herbal tea, not as far as an essential oil use. You're going to always see birch and wintergreen, toxic. You're going to see the same group of oils over and over again, toxic for all kinds of things. And so we just discussed essential oils and seizures. Well, here it is again, camphor, fennel, all right? But then what's interesting is that a lot of the writers say that the lemon-scented things should also be avoided during pregnancy. Now, I don't know if there's any real basis in this. And a lot of the writers actually comment and they say, you know, there is absolutely no documented evidence that aromatherapy has caused any medical crises during pregnancy. And that's a good observation, okay? We're not seeing the same thing that we are seeing with these adverse reaction reports. Okay, now the adverse reaction reports, which I brought to your attention in the early part of this course, these are hundreds and hundreds of documented cases of people having seizures and contact dermatitis and gastritis and neurological damage and hepatotoxicity. These are emergency room cases. None of those are related to pregnancy, okay? But all of them are related to internal consumption or undiluted external applications. So again, this information does not necessarily mean that if you have a little bit of lemongrass essential oil in a diffuser, that it's even going to be problematic. But these things are cautionary principles. And so many of the authors say the lemon-scented oils like lemongrass and lemon balm and lemon eucalyptus and lemon tea tree, these things should be avoided. Well, I don't know exactly why, but I did find that these are mentioned, and so let's just be on the safe side. Now, mugwort is full of toxic compounds that are linked to seizures, okay? Myrtle is sort of a questionable one in terms of its dangers. Pennyroyal is definitely dangerous because it's an abortifacient, and that's actually where a lot of the negative reports about essential oils have come out. With this particular oil specifically, is because pennyroyal was reputed to basically be able to induce a miscarriage, and many women in the first trimester who did not want to go for an abortion or could not get one tried to use it, and it is more toxic than an abortifacient, and so they got very sick from it. So that is why that one's there. Sage, again, we have a certain camphor and other toxic compounds in there, camphor compounds in the Spanish lavender, which we do not we have not talked about in this course. Tansy, tarragon, thujo, which has the thujones in it, which, you know, again, you've heard about in relation to the seizures. Thymol, wintergreen again, wormwood, yarrow. Okay, these are the toxic oils. This is a good collection of toxic oils. And these are oils that I haven't focused on. And the main reason that you haven't heard anything about these is because they're specialized and they are problematic. And I am only teaching you oils that are safe because you are a large, diverse group of people all over the world, and I don't know anything about you. And I just want you to work with oils that are very low risk. So at the bottom of this file, helpful aromatherapy treatments during pregnancy. That means diffuser, massage, and baths, especially in later stages. Well, for what? Headaches and migraines. Well, these are just a few of the basic things we've covered. Lavender, frankincense, chamomiles, these are all safe in the diffuser and for massage and for baths later in pregnancy. Muscle soreness, don't use a birch or wintergreen, but you could use cypress. That's a relatively mild oil. Lavender and juniper. Those are some oils that we have covered. Nerve pain, you'll remember this, is St. John's wort and the calendula infused oils. That's a good choice to go to as a carrier oil. Ginger oil is warming. And I would not advise it during the first trimester. I wouldn't advise any aromatherapy just to be on the safe side during the first trimester. But then the frankincense and the helichrysum, very, very good. But always keep in mind that helichrysum, you do not want to use it in the earlier stages because it is a demagogue stimulant. But in the later stages, especially diluted, especially for a specific application like nerve pain, I think you can cross over and use it safely. Smaller amounts. Hormone balancing, you want to feel better at the hormonal level. Chamomile, bergamot, all the citruses actually are very mild and helpful, except for this contraindication of lavender, perhaps. And then the neroli and the ylang ylang. And then, again, anxiety, bergamot, neroli, lavender, and ylang ylang. And so that basically covers a quick review of the topic of pregnancy and aromatherapy, because we touched on it, but I didn't give you all of the lists and all of that. Now, if you go back to the link to Module 16, and you will see that there's a file for aromatherapy for children. Just to review this quickly, you'll see here the general safety rules that I gave you. We don't need to review that. I mentioned that you must use very, very low dilutions, and so here I have spelled it out, 0.5. to 1% dilution, maximum 3 to 6 drops per ounce. And then I broke it down again, newborn to 3 months. Don't use anything, just to be on the safe side. Now, maybe you are in a home where you are raising your children all naturally, organically. They're running around. They know their herbs because they're growing in the garden. They've been raised with healthy food. When they get a sore throat, they come to you and they say, can I have a little shot of golden seal and echinacea? If they, you know, get a little burn, they come to you and they say, can I have some lavender oil? In that kind of family where herbs and essential oils are already being used, well, you don't have to stop using them in a diffuser, but the problem is that parents are being told, put oregano oil directly undiluted on the skin of infants, okay? Now, that's not wise. And so following the basic cautions, just don't use anything for the first several months. And then for the first couple of years, after 3 months, very minimal exposure. And you could just start with a little bit in the background diffuser only. Very mild things like lavender, geranium, chamomile, conifers. But, and this is why I gave you these links again to the vaccine issue, because the vaccine issue is closely related to the immunological sensitivities. And that is closely related to the antibiotic use and the immunological damage and the asthma and all of that. And so, therefore, if you have kids like that, you're dealing with those kind of health problems, you must be extremely cautious with essential oils. Now, in general, if you were to compare the dangers of using some lavender in a diffuser with the dangers of a child being on antibiotics at age 2 or being on asthma inhalers at age 4 or being exposed to multiple vaccines within the first 2 weeks, or being on Ritalin for years starting at age 5, I think that you can see that the comparative level of danger is practically non-existent. Okay, we're talking about really heavy medications that kids are being put on all the time, and multiple medications also. But what we are thinking about here is that everybody wants to blame the natural medicine if something happens, okay? And so there's the political side of it, which I have mentioned many times, and that is you want to be very sensitive. You want to not expose a child to something that may trigger an allergic reaction. And, of course, it can happen, okay? If you use certain types of eucalyptus in too strong a concentration for a highly reactive kid, they might get an asthma reaction. They might have an allergic reaction. There's no doubt that that is a risk, okay? But it's a higher risk for the kids who are immunologically really sensitive. But what we want to do is just make sure that not only are we not exposing them to those things that can do it, we also want to make sure in general that we're just not contributing to the situation at all, because a lot of times, even if the essential oil or the herb is not doing something, the kids are highly reactive. They're reacting to all kinds of things. They're reacting to the gluten in the pizza that they just ate. They're reacting to drinking more milk. They're reacting to the mold in the house. They're reacting to things, okay? And so this is why I say that aromatherapy for kids at this particular level is very important to first take care of the basic lifestyle improvements, the health improvements. That is something that I articulated last week. I'll just say it again. Make sure that you're not getting ahead of yourself with the treatment of the kids with these really strong essential oils if you're not even feeding them a good diet. Okay, that's just general advice. Then we go from 2 to 5 years old, the immune system is developing, nervous system is developing, and then you can start to bring in more of the essential oils, and probably by 5 years, everything's relatively safe. And here you can use the generally considered safe oils, minimal exposure in diffusers, highly diluted in massage oil or the bath, and then these are the main oils that are very safe and also for pregnancy, same ones, lavender, Roman chamomile, orange, bergamot, frankincense, geranium, ginger, lemon, marjoram, tea tree, thyme. Avoid most of the other oils. But you can see here that with these oils, you can actually do a lot. You can do a lot for stress. You can do a lot for nervousness and anxiety, hyperactivity, concentration, all of that. Then when the kids are older and you've got teens running around, you can bring in all kinds of things, okay? And cedar is a good one. You've got a monograph on that. You can use the different species of eucalyptus. Now, you will notice here that I mentioned eucalyptus smithii. This is a specific species of eucalyptus that is generally acknowledged by aromatherapy writers to be somewhat less reactive or somewhat less serious as a trigger for kids who may have eucalyptus reactions. But again, I don't know where this information is coming from. I don't know. I can say practically 100% confidently that there haven't been any studies actually measuring and testing the reactivity level of different species of eucalypti to different groups of kids. I know that. Okay, so where this information is coming from, I think that what happens is that one person will make some observations about something in aromatherapy, and then they will pass it around. The next thing you know, it's like an urban legend. It's an established fact. And when a certain reputable author can write something and say, eucalyptus species should be avoided by children because they're more reactive, well, okay, if there's some strong evidence to back it up, then I think that's something to consider. And even if there isn't, it's something to consider because we don't want to cause any unnecessary problems. Now, in one of the modules coming up, we only have a couple more to go, but in one of the modules on the unusual species, I'm going to actually unpack all the different kinds of lavenders and different species of eucalyptus and so forth and talk about some of the different ways that they're used. And this is where you're going to hear eucalyptus smithii, okay? It's considered by aromatherapists to be less triggering for kids and some of the other ones. Okay, but also the frankincense of citruses, lemon tea tree, which is a manuka oil. That's very good for colds and flus, marjoram, rosemary, peppermint. I told you a story last week about the kids at the psychiatric hospital. We gave them the choice of which oils they'd like to use for their relaxing session, and kids just love peppermint. Why not? Let them have it, okay? So a couple other things here, hyperactivity. I went ahead and I put a few of the major oils, lavender, geranium, vetiver, sandalwood, ylang ylang. And then these are things you've heard before for concentration, lavender, rosemary, mint, citrus, conifers, eucalyptus. And then rather than just go on with all of this, I'm just mentioning that for treatment of colds and flus for kids, you know, who are basically 5, 8 and up, you can just follow the adult protocols for colds and flus that you'll see in modules 4 and 5, respiratory system, and same with digestive complaints 6 and 7. Okay, so that's a quick overview and a little bit more information there for you. And then we have just a few more comments that I want to make now about essential oils for elderly people. And this will take us into some discussion now about combining essential oils with allopathic medications, and we've already done that. We've already covered some of that with many of the studies and also with the little research project that we did on anti-seizure medications. So I just want to briefly mention that there are a number of studies for aromatherapy in hospice care, aromatherapy for the elderly, and many of the problems for elderly patients. And I just want to give a very brief synopsis of a lot of information that I've come across, and that is that aromatherapy can be very, very beneficial for the elderly, but they have some special needs. The number one concern is the interaction with any medications. Now, on the one hand, we do need to take this quite seriously and we do need to do the research, but on the other hand, I think there is actually very little evidence that if used properly, that the majority of what we could call the safe group of oils, which I've listed several times now, are going to be problematic. Now, on the other hand, the other oils that I have mentioned several times as being toxic oils and the compounds that are in those that I have mentioned, those should also be avoided for the elderly. But really, those should be avoided by everybody. I mean, there's really no need, okay, to use wormwood oil. There's really no need to use thuja oil, okay? Thuja oil, the cedar leaf oil, has one specific purpose only in aromatherapy, as far as I know. And that is direct application of one drop on a wart, you know, a couple times a day, all right? It is known as a specific remedy for warts, okay? But we're not breathing it. We're putting it directly on a wart, all right? And other than that, don't diffuse it. Don't use it in the bath. Don't use it in massage, right? So many of these toxic oils have no purpose anyway, all right? There's no need to use them. The only two that we have covered are going to be birch and wintergreen, and the reason that I put them in there was to give you all the warnings about them because they're commonly found in lots of products, commonly used and abused, and they're very, very helpful if you use them correctly. But other than that, just skip all those. And so when we look at the file of oils to avoid now for medications, you're going to see the same list of oils again, same basic list. Just don't use them. Now, the other primary concern is that elderly people are more sensitive, just like with children. They're more immunologically sensitive, and they're also very sensitive in the skin. Okay, so as we get older, our skin gets more dried out. We lose connective tissue. Skin becomes fragile, and therefore it becomes more prone to contact dermatitis if the oils are used improperly. Therefore, the use of the carrier oils becomes increasingly important, and the use of the essential oils on the skin becomes increasingly problematic. And we're going to talk about essential oils on the skin next week, and what we're going to find is that there's actually very, very few essential oils that are actually good for the skin directly. There's many that can be very beneficial if they're used in a carrier oil and with herbal medicated oils and so forth. But by themselves, essential oils are drying and potentially dermotoxic. You already know all of that. And as we get older, this risk increases. And so you must think, as you get older or your clients get older, you must think moving away from essential oils, moving more towards the nutritive side of using carrier oils. And so it doesn't stay in the realm of aromatherapy so much. It actually starts to move into the realm of what Ayurveda calls Abhyanga, which is the warm oil application on the skin. And that's a nutritive therapy as opposed to either an antimicrobial therapy from the essential oils or a limbic system treatment for emotions. So these are the two primary concerns when doing aromatherapy with older patients is be very careful about the toxic oils and the potential interaction with medication, although it's practically unknown what could do that and who's going to be sensitive and so forth, and probably a lot safer than we think from the olfactory standpoint. And also think of the skin. Now, when we come to the list of things that can be benefited for elderly people, the list is fairly common and common sense. As we get older, we start to feel more pain. Well, I mean, kids feel pain too, but we start to develop new pains. We start to have degenerative discs. We start to have bone spurs on the spine that are irritating nerves. We start to have stiffness in the musculoskeletal system. Well, we've already covered that. And a lot of those treatments are going to be very helpful and applicable. You just need to modify them a bit according to the safety guidelines that I have just given you. So there's good medicated herbal oils we talked about for carrier oils, for nerve pain. You've got all kinds of protocols for muscular pain, tension, all these kind of things. So aromatherapy massage, okay, for the elderly is very appreciated. As we get older, the more we appreciate a massage. And I would have to say that unless you really abuse essential oils in a massage oil, that you're probably going to be totally safe, okay, unless you are just really doing something out of line here, just pouring essential oils directly on the skin, you know, excessive amounts of concentration. Most likely, if you're making a standard blend of a massage oil, it's going to be fine. And there's so many things you could use, and I've given you some of my favorites. I've told you that vetiver, for example, in a carrier oil is excellent for muscular tension, tightness, inflammation, stiffness of the joints. Okay, now vetiver is also very nourishing for the skin, and so if you were to take a simple carrier oil like sesame and put vetiver in it, well, then you're combining the best of both worlds, because the sesame oil from Ayurveda is the number one oil for Abhyanga, for nourishing. And you put a little vetiver in it, it's also nourishing for the skin. So there's lots of good ideas that we talked about there to consider for musculoskeletal tension. And a good massage, as we get older, becomes more and more appreciated, and aromatherapy is definitely very helpful. So another thing that can be benefited tremendously as we get older is going to be the anxiety and depression. And this is especially true for patients who are in later stages of life, in hospice, they're bedridden, okay, or they can't get out, or they're starting to be affected by dementia. And we did talk about that. We talked about the neurodegenerative conditions, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia, and you have some treatment protocols, some specific essential oils that you should automatically be able to think of right away, okay, rosemary, lemon balm. But massage will also be very helpful because touch is so nourishing to the nervous system. And so therefore, any of the relaxing oils are going to be very helpful for this. We're going to see that the citruses, again, neroli is going to be a major anxiolytic. You're going to always think of lavender. You're going to think of rose. You're going to think of bergamot, but always be aware that the citruses are phototoxic, so use them later in the day so they have a chance to wear off. So these kind of oils, and the flower oils, are going to be very, very beneficial for elderly people. Another thing, elderly people are going to benefit from abdominal massage because digestion becomes weaker, there's lower hydrochloric acid, there's more acidity, there's more tendency to constipation. And so nice abdominal massage with just the safer oils, the things that we've already talked about, okay, are going to be very helpful. But you can also go back and you can review and you can see that the same oils that we talked about that are going to be beneficial for all ages will also apply here. For example, a little bit of cardamom essential oil and fennel or a few drops of black pepper. As long as all of these are properly diluted, you do the circular clockwise abdominal massage very, very gently for elderly people. That can be tremendously helpful for soothing digestive kinds of problems. And then there's also, you know, besides the anxiety and depression, as we get older, we often lose things that are valuable to us. We lose a spouse. We start seeing mortality more clearly, and it becomes harder to metabolize things. And aromatherapy and stress in general the aromatherapy is number one choice for all kinds of emotional stress. But we've also talked about loss and grief, and I gave some protocols. I have mentioned that some oils have a reputation, like rose. Rose for elderly people, I think, is a very, very good choice, but all the flower oils. But rose has a specific connotation for helping to heal the heart. And I've also mentioned that, well, it's not just so much that this oil has this specific effect. It's also what is it that the person really responds to? Maybe it's vanilla. Maybe it's something else that just reminds them of something pleasant. Okay, so something like that, a good way to approach aromatherapy for elderly people. All right, so I will put those brief notes in another file for next week, just so if you found that it was going by too quickly, you're going to have it just like the files here. And now we can continue transitioning into our discussion about medications. So I'll just preface this and say again that this is an area that nobody really knows much about. And there's several reasons for that. One is that it's very hard, first of all, to even predict how people are going to react to medications that are being prescribed. So our primary topic here is using aromatherapy safely in conjunction with other medications. Now, this is the topic of herb-drug interaction. Now, what we find in the field of herb-drug interaction is that there are a small number of medications that are known to be problematic when it comes to taking herbal medicine. And those, I don't remember all of them, but they include the serotonin uptake inhibitors, reuptake inhibitors, the primary class of anxiolytics and antidepressants, and a major herb is contraindicated is St. John's wort with that. And paradoxically, the reason it's contraindicated is because it detoxifies your liver, and that reduces the amount of medication in your bloodstream. So that's one example. Another example is if you are on blood thinners like warfarin. Okay, well, if you take herbs like ginkgo that have a blood thinning effect, that's going to enhance the blood thinning effect of the medication and could promote bleeding. Okay. Another is if you are on an immunosuppressant drug because of an organ transplant, and you are taking immune-boosting herbs, okay, that's a contraindication. Those are a few examples that come to mind right away, and those are three examples. There's basically only about four or five major medications that really produce significant problems with specific herbs. Now, keep in mind that the primary difference there is because people are ingesting the herb. They're taking the herb and it is going through the liver, it is mixing with the prescription drug in the metabolism, all right, at the cellular level, at the bloodstream level, in the liver, and so forth. That is not the case with essential oils, because we're not ingesting the essential oils. So right away, we can extrapolate from that that there's very likely a decreased risk of herb-drug interaction when it comes to aromatherapy and medications, okay? That if we're breathing the essential oils in, it's a completely different route of administration, as we have explored, okay? If you're breathing it in, it's going to affect primarily the respiratory system, and it's going to affect primarily the neurological system, olfactory system, limbic system. And the way that that affects it is in a very transient kind of immediate way that evaporates rather quickly. That's different than if you are taking repeated doses of ginkgo while you are on a blood-thinning medication. It's going to actually get into your metabolism over a longer period of time and actually change your physiology. I don't think that the essential oils are going to change your physiology at that level through the sense of smell. So right away, we know that we're overall in a much safer area. Okay, now let's go ahead and we can open up this file titled Essential Oils That Should Be Avoided with Anticoagulant Drugs. And I gave this, we were talking about anti-seizure medications, I'm sorry, but this is from some different aromatherapy sources, and there's two things here that are mentioned, avoided with anticoagulant drugs and avoided with blood glucose medications. Okay, well, where did this information come from? Is there any particular study about this? Are these things known to cause problems? There's a lot of material in the aromatherapy world that is basically just the cautionary principle, okay? I know that there are no studies or cases of people having herb-drug interactions here, because look at what it says. All of these are for oral use, okay? That means that people must drink the essential oils before they're going to be contraindicated with the anticoagulant drugs or the blood glucose medications. So it's probably a combination of common sense and looking at some chemistry and understanding that if you ingest really high levels of this particular compound, that it's going to have an adverse reaction in your physiology, and that's also going to affect the medication. But let's look at this. In the first group, anticoagulant medications, what you're going to see is this group of oils, and the only contraindication is don't drink them. don't take them internally if you are on anticoagulant drugs. Now, what that tells me is that is another justification for not taking essential oils internally. And I wouldn't be surprised if some people who have been having adverse reactions that have been reported or ending up in emergency rooms, probably some of those adverse reactions are because they are taking essential oils, maybe this group or not, maybe something else, and they're more sensitive. Their liver is burdened from the prescription drugs already. They have an underlying condition, and then they're taking the essential oils on top of that. That is increasing their hepatotoxicity or neurotoxicity. That's where the adverse reactions are coming from. So this list is basils and birch and cinnamon and clove and fennel and lavandin, which we haven't talked about, which is another species of lavender, and marjoram and myrtle and oregano and patchouli and ravensar, and on down to wintergreen. But what I would say is if you are on any anticoagulant medications, don't take any essential oils internally, period. But then there's another interesting piece of information, and this is important and practical. Don't use birch and don't use wintergreen externally either, okay, or in a diffuser or in any form. Don't use birch or wintergreen in any form. And I think that that makes perfect sense, okay? That's very easy to understand because birch and wintergreen are rubifacients, meaning that they stimulate peripheral capillary circulation, all right? And therefore, anything that's going to do that is going to also mix with an anticoagulant type of effect. That makes perfect sense. So just take this as an example of a list that you can find in aromatherapy literature. But I would say this is an incomplete list. I would say extend this out. And if you're going to say, what oils should you not take internally? All of them you should not take internally. And you now have a new reason, which is that if you are on anticoagulant drugs, it may have an adverse reaction, especially these. Now, here's another list, essential oils that could interfere with blood glucose medications. Well, how is this determined versus others? I would say probably the same thing, common sense, some major compounds, a little bit of physiology. But I would say just don't take any essential oils if you are on blood glucose medications internally, okay? And so cinnamon, fennel, geranium. I don't think this list really is all that relevant. If you just follow that basic rule, don't take essential oils internally, you're going to be fine. All right. So that's a little discussion about that. Now, I did want to point out a couple other things where aromatherapy is very helpful. So now if you'll go back to the link to Module 16, and now we can look at cancer treatment. And also the topic of using essential oils for cancer. All right, now those are two different subjects, two very different subjects. And the reason that I am separating them here is because we see a lot of studies on aromatherapy for cancer patients that are very positive for the most part. Some are mixed results, but for the most part, the use of aromatherapy in massage, diffuser, inhalation from a perfume strip, these types of applications, very beneficial for a lot of the different aspects of cancer treatment. But it's not treating the cancer. That's the difference. And the reason that I'm mentioning this is because now there has been this epidemic of information floating around that essential oils will cure cancer. And all kinds of discussion about use this oil and it will cure cancer, this type of cancer and all that. Now there is evidence that certain compounds in certain oils will work in a petri dish against certain cell lines, certain cancer cell lines. But that does not mean you can drink the essential oil and it will kill the cancer. That's, again, what's happened between the confusion of an in vitro study being used for marketing purposes. Okay, so that's going to be the second topic. So if you'll go ahead and open the file, aromatherapy and cancer treatment. This is actually very interesting and important because what it tells us is that there are many, many studies about using essential oils and aromatherapy for different aspects of cancer treatment that are, for the most part, quite beneficial. There is nothing mentioned here about herb-drug interaction. You're not going to see anything. I didn't come across any studies saying these cancer patients should not be breathing lavender oil. Okay? So I think what that tells us is that for the most part, again, aromatherapy is safe at the olfactory level. It's safe at the diluted massage level and the diffuser level and the inhalation level. It's not safe at the oral ingestion level. Now, what I did, since there are so many studies here, I organized them according to topic, and then I highlighted in red the conclusions, because all we need to know, really, is just what did they study and what were the results. So we don't need to go through all of this because of time, but I'll just give you some examples. Constipation. Effectiveness of aroma massage on advanced cancer patients with constipation. Results. Conclusion. The findings of the study suggest aroma massage can help relieve constipation in patients with advanced cancer. Okay. That's excellent to know, especially if you are working with cancer patients. So now we go back up. We say, all right, well, what did they use? Okay, well, in this particular study, they didn't actually say. They didn't say we used this particular oil. So it's not very helpful in that way. Now comes a whole bunch of studies about pain, and the results are mixed. Is aromatherapy massage going to treat deep cancer pain? Well, I think common sense would say, no, not really. And that's what a lot of the studies say. Well, it's kind of beneficial at a psychological level, but it doesn't really treat pain. Okay, well, you know, when people need to be on morphine, you can't expect lavender oil massage to make a huge difference. Okay, so let's just look at this. Pain. Aromatherapy hand massage. This isn't even whole body massage. This is just massaging the hands, okay, with aromatherapy oil for older adults with chronic pain living in long-term care. Well, what does it say? The conclusions. This technique of hand massage with or without aromatherapy significantly decreased chronic pain intensity. All right. Well, they didn't say what oils are doing it. Now, this is just, these are studies that to me are like scientists telling us that the sky is blue. You know, they're saying, well, all right, you give an elderly person a hand massage, it's going to make them more comfortable. But the thing that's interesting, significantly decreased chronic pain intensity. All right. Well, that's a nice thing to know. How about the same aroma hand massage on pain, anxiety, and depression in hospice patients with terminal cancer? Conclusion, aroma hand massage had a positive effect on pain and depression. Okay, great. Well, do they say what they used? All right. Now we see that there's some specific information here. Bergamot, lavender, frankincense. And they gave you some specific ratios. Now, do you think really that that's going to make all that much difference what oil you use? Could you pick any type of citrus? Is it really going to make that much difference whether you use bergamot or whether you use orange? Or is it really going to make that much difference between lavender and geranium or between frankincense and one species and frankincense between another species? Because it's a hand massage. That's what is really difficult to pin down about aromatherapy. And everybody wants to know the specific oil for the specific cure. It's very open. It's a very inexact art and science. But the important conclusion, it had a positive effect on pain and depression. All right, now next one. Aromatherapy massage in a hospice setting, all right? And this one says, we were unable to demonstrate any significant long-term benefits of aromatherapy or massage. However, sleep scores improved, significantly, and there were significant reductions in depression. Okay, so basically what they're saying is that people felt better, but it didn't really have a long-term effect. Okay, my suggestion is give them another massage. All right, so now how about this one? Clinical effects of aromatherapy massage on reducing pain. And the conclusion, aromatherapy massage does not appear to reduce pain of cancer patients, but more studies with more objective measures should be done. All right, that's a good conclusion also, even though it, you know, it's mixed, all right, as you would expect. So more studies about pain and cancer. Let's just go ahead and skip down here. Massage and aromatherapy confer short-term benefits on psychological well-being. Okay, well, great. That's a lot more than a lot of people are getting in a hospital setting. How about aromatherapy to support hypnosis for pain management? Now, I threw this one in because this is a very intriguing study looked at from the perspective that we have talked about before, which is using fragrance to train our mind. And I started off this particular module talking about how I use Neroli to train myself to have less stage fright, or no stage fright, actually. And this is a similar kind of thing. So what I was doing when I put those drops of Neroli on my palms and breathed it and then visualized it, going into a deeply relaxed state and visualized it, I was doing a form of self-hypnosis. I was telling myself, you're going to enjoy this. You're going to enjoy it. And I would visualize it, and I would feel the effects of the Neroli relaxing me, and I would start to associate the mental imagination of getting in front of a large group of people with relaxed, pleasant body sensations. Well, that's the same thing that hypnosis is doing, and that's why I wanted to include that, because it also is the same thing we're doing when we breathe rosemary oil to imprint information that we're studying. Well, the study is basically chronic pain due to disease or injury persists even after interventions to alleviate these conditions. We know that. Hypnosis has been shown to be an effective treatment and may be enhanced by the use of olfactory stimulation as a post-hypnotic cue. I think that's very interesting. What that means is that we can not only use essential oils to increase our concentration and memory and our recall, our cognitive function, we can use it to reduce fears and phobias, and we can also use it to trigger post-hypnotic memories of being deeply relaxed and out of pain. All right, I thought that was very interesting. Now we see the usual information about anxiety. Okay, so anxiolytic effect of aromatherapy massage in patients with breast cancer. And so this one says the results showed that anxiety was reduced in one 30-minute aromatherapy massage. Okay. The results further suggested that aromatherapy massage ameliorated the immunological state. Okay, so it's good for your immune system. Okay, anxiolytic effect of Neroli. Here's another one on chronic myeloid leukemia. Results showed that the Neroli oil has an anxiolytic effect and reduces the signs and symptoms associated with anxiety. Well, we already know that. We're already way ahead of these scientists here. So here's another thing, just a few studies here briefly about how complementary medicine is used so widely. Parents are using complementary medicine for their children who have cancer. Now, a couple of things here about chemotherapy. You've already seen these here when we talked about the digestive system. And we did a little study on the use of aromatherapy for counteracting nausea, okay? And this was the aroma sticks, you remember, the aroma sticks. And the oils that were used, lavender, lemon, frankincense, and so forth. And the results, if you scroll down, catch up with me here on page, top of page 11, In anxious patients, 65% reported feeling more relaxed, 51% felt less stressed, 47% of the nausea patients said that the aroma stick had settled their nausea, and 55% of those experiencing sleep disturbances felt that the aroma stick helped them sleep. Well, that's way better than just placebo effects, so something must be going on. Okay, now, quality of life for hospice patients. Okay, so this crosses back into elderly, the use for elderly patients here. Results reflected a positive but small change in blood pressure, pulse, pain, depression, anxiety, sense of well-being after using both the control treatment and the lavender treatment. All right. So I'll just let you finish with the last of these. I'll just mention them here, the lymphedema, boosting the immune system. Oh, here's a study here that ends. This is using aromatherapy with Thai massage, okay? Aromatherapy with light Thai massage can be beneficial for the immune systems of cancer patients who are undergoing chemotherapy by increasing the number of lymphocytes and can help reduce the severity of common symptoms. Okay, very nice. Now, that's a very important study because what it's saying is that they were actually looking at the function of the white blood cells, the lymphocytes, they were actually doing before and after tests, okay? And so what they found, Thai massage and aromatherapy could boost lymphocyte numbers by 11%. That's a pretty significant boost of your immune system. Okay, finally, aromatherapy and radiotherapy. Aromatherapy as administered in this study, meaning for patients who are going through radiation treatment, is not beneficial. Well, okay, let's find out why. Okay, what they used was essential oils of lavender, bergamot, cedarwood, okay, and they were testing for anxiety and depression. Well, okay, maybe if they had used neroli, they would have had a better result. Or maybe it's just because radiation treatment is a different kind of treatment. We don't really know. So I hope that this type of information is helpful for you and you find it interesting. I know it's tedious to read the studies, but I'd like to give you the overall summation because really, you know, we have, as I've mentioned, three main sources of information. We have historical ethnobotanical uses of the plants, and in order to understand the essential oil use in modern times, we have to actually understand herbology, okay, and how it goes back. The other is we have what's called aromatherapy. Well, aromatherapy is very, very new, okay? It is less than 100 years old, very little information about it, and a lot of it is just empirical, and a lot of it is just the same information passed around from one author to another, and a lot of it is very questionable. A lot of it is common sense, but a lot of it is questionable. Why does this person say this group of oils should be avoided? Okay, well, maybe there's some solid evidence there. Maybe it's just that it's common sense, or maybe they just got it from somewhere else. Okay, so that's the general condition of aromatherapy right now. But I think that what's going to really improve the general status of aromatherapy as a medical field is going to come from two directions. One, there's going to be more and more input from herbalists who are bringing in that traditional ethnobotanical foundation of information. But there's also going to be the third source, and that is this modern scientific research. And that's very important for people who need proof also. I will mention that, you know. A lot of people who are doing alternative medicine don't need proof because they already know that it works. It works in some particular way. But for practitioners, we need to know a bit more about, how much variability is there, and do we really need to know the exact species of eucalyptus if we're giving parents a prescription for an asthmatic child? All right. It has to be a lot more specific than what's currently there in the aromatherapy world, and that's where this type of scientific information is important. It's important to consider a lot of it, however, is stuff we already know, and a lot of it sometimes it's contradictory, and especially with the olfactory sense. It's very hard to measure a lot of these things because a lot of these things are subjective, emotional experiences that are difficult to gauge. Okay, now there's another file here This is important that we cover because there's been some controversy about essential oils interacting with our glandular system. So if you go back to the link, Module 16, and you click on the file, Hormonal Effects of Essential Oils, all right? And I've summed this all up. Again, there's many, many pages here, but I want to basically scan through and give you the overall view of the estrogenic oil debate, or I should say controversy, which isn't really a controversy. It's been pretty much put to rest at this point. But the top sentence here on this file sums it up from my opinion. In general, there's relatively little known about the hormonal effects of essential oils, and the information is contradictory and the conclusions uncertain. All right, so let's just go through this. This first study here, assessment of estrogenic activity in some common essential oil constituents. And the conclusion, these results show that very high concentrations of some commonly used essential oil constituents appear to have potential to interact with estrogen receptors, although the biological significance of this is uncertain. Well, okay, but what does very high concentration mean? All right. Well, I don't really know, and it doesn't even really say here. And so what does that mean to me? Well, it means to me, don't take essential oils internally. Okay, another one here, and this is related to a big controversy that's coming up. Antiandrogen, okay, well, androgen basically means that it's anti-testosterone, okay? And this is the controversy. A study came out several years ago titled Pubertal gynecomastia in chronic lavender exposure, a report of three cases. Well, this is a study that caused a tremendous amount of controversy and worry and concern amongst parents because these doctors reported that they had these three boys that came in who were growing breasts, and they attributed this to the use of tea tree oil and lavender oil as found in shampoos. Well, this study was pretty much immediately and completely debunked because it's very difficult to make that kind of link. And then what they found was that the study was very poorly done. There's countless other factors, all these types of things. And many, many other reports came out, actually, debunking this one. Now, my response was I found the whole thing rather humorous. And what I said, you know, because I started getting all kinds of emails from worried parents, is my boy going to grow breasts if I have lavender in the diffuser? I mean, that was the concern. And I had two responses. No, I had three responses. My first response was, if lavender has this effect, then all the men in the south of France who work in the lavender industry should have breasts, and they don't. These guys are out, lavender farmers, they're out there and they're harvesting the flowers, they're handling lavender oil, they get lavender oil all over themselves every day during the summer. They're distilling it, they're pouring it. I mean, I've seen these guys working, you know, they've got lavender oil on their hands and their arms all day long. And no, they don't have breasts. There's not an epidemic of gynecomastia in the south of France. The other obvious thing that I pointed out was if this was actually true, there would be somebody making money off of this because breast enhancement products would be very popular if it actually worked. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't do anything for breast enhancement at all. And so then finally, after, you know, the humorous answers, I told people, you know, all of these herbal and aromatherapy organizations have all, even scientific organizations, even the Journal of the American Medical Association debunked this particular study. So that was a controversy. I just wanted to point it out. And so there was a rebuttal to this particular study here, and you can read this rebuttal. And there were a number of other studies that were done that showed that, well, okay, there could be other factors. You know, maybe It's contamination of the essential oils. Maybe there's plastics that are getting in the essential oils because, you know, the essential oils are being stored in plastic, and those can definitely have a hormonal effect. All right, so that's a summation of this kind of ridiculous thing that came out, and I think it was politically motivated. Who knows who funded that study? But one of the conclusions here, based on these data, lavender oil at these particular doses was not active in the rat uterotrophic assay and gave no evidence of estrogenic activity. All right, so it was debunked, basically. However, I found some interesting studies that lavender and tea tree can actually get rid of excess body hair in young women, okay, and that's a hormonal problem. But they're applying the oil externally. So what does that mean? Okay, so the conclusion of this study is that it represents a safe, economic, and practical instrument in the cure of this particular disease. All right. So a few other things. I think we need to move on to our final file here, but I'll sum this up. A couple other things here that are intriguing is that there are actually some studies that are a bit curious, okay? So I found one here, and this is not about essential oils, but we could probably extrapolate something maybe. Spearmint and peppermint teas are implicated in anti-androgen effects. This may or may not be relevant in aromatherapy. Those are my comments, okay? Now, this particular study, and I don't know where this came from, but it says that the effect of peppermint tea on plasma testosterone, follicle-stimulating hormone, testicular tissue in rats, and so forth. But I highlighted one particular sentence here because it's saying that peppermint and spearmint teas are affecting the glandular system in men, and highlighted, we performed this study because of major complaints in our area for men about the adverse effects of these herbs on male reproductive functions. Well, I have no idea where this particular area was, and I have no idea what the complaints were either. But apparently, maybe it's in a growing area where they're growing a lot of peppermint and spearmint tea, and for some reason the men are complaining about the effects on their reproductive system, and I have no idea of what it is. But the conclusion is, despite the beneficial effects of peppermint and spearmint in digestion, we should also be aware of the toxic effects when the herbs are not used in the recommended fashion or at the recommended dose. Now, that's not news to any of you, because I have always told you peppermint oil is a very difficult oil to work with. Now, it does have some very specific uses. We find it a lot in the antispasmodic, the digestive combinations that you see there, a few things in the musculoskeletal module. But in general, I'm not a fan of the mint oils, okay? And so here's another one here, Thu Joan. I'll just let you read this. We're almost done, down to the bottom here. Okay, and a couple other studies here. Production process contamination of citrus oils by plastic materials. Okay, now, these studies are many years old, actually, and I know for a fact that distillers are much more aware of this now, that they're not letting essential oils come in contact with plastics, especially those that have certification as organic producers. But plastics are still found in essential oils, and this is another reason that we should be very cautious about taking essential oils internally, because if they are low-grade essential oils going through standard kind of perfume channels, it's entirely possible that some essential oils sat around in some plastic container for a few months somewhere, and the phthalates leached out, and those compounds do have endocrine-disrupting functions. All right, so I wanted to bring that to your attention. Now, finally, I wanted to bring the cancer topic to your attention. We're a little bit over time, but I'm just going to wrap it up. Very quickly, if you would open up this particular file that is titled In Vitro Studies on Essential Oils Against Cancer Cell Lines. Now, this is extremely interesting. The main reason that this is interesting is because of the misrepresentation of this information in marketing. And what's happening is that these studies are being done. I'm just going to sum up this entire file for you here. You will see here that there are many studies that are being done using essential oils and essential oil compounds in vitro, meaning in a petri dish, against specific cell lines. And so you'll see that there's a study against bladder cancer cells, pancreatic cancer cells, a couple other types, okay, breast cancer cells. All right, now that's not a clinical trial using these oils injected into human beings. That's in vivo. And the reason why is because the essential oils are not biocompatible at that level. But they're finding that the essential oil compounds in vitro are anti-cancer. That is extremely important. I wanted to also bring to your attention that there are many studies about frankincense, and you'll notice that mostly for the studies what I do is I take out the author information, but I left in the author information on a couple of these because it's really intriguing. Guess what we find here? Frankincense essential oil prepared from hydrodistillation of Boswellia sacra gum resins induces human pancreatic cancer cell death in cultures. That's great. Well, there's a whole series of people who were involved with that, including Young G. Well, I did a little research on it. This is Gary Young of Young Living Essential Oils. And, you know, I got to hand it to the guy. This is the way that you do it, okay? This is brilliant, actually, all right? You work with scientists, and you have your oils studied, and you come up with this kind of information. And that is very powerful. It's a very positive, major contribution to medicine, all right? And so good for him. Now, the downside of it is that the multi-level marketing reps are going around telling people that frankincense cures cancer. Well, there's no evidence that frankincense cures cancer in a living human being yet because they have not found the way to administer it. Frankincense oil kills these cancer cells in a petri dish. That is very important to know. And now the next thing that's going to happen is that drugs will be developed so that those compounds can be delivered in a biocompatible way to the tissues and the cells so that they will kill the cancer. That is probably coming. And so this is preliminary, incredibly important information. Now, what we have to be aware of is that people are telling other people through internet medicine, if you put frankincense oil directly on the breast, you will cure the tumor. All right, that's where this information breaks down. Okay, in the petri dish, it kills the cancer cell line. It will not do that if you put the essential oil on the breast. There are several examples of this floating around. I just want to make a statement about it. So far, there has been no documented case that I know of, and I think I would probably hear about it, of somebody knowing a safe way to ingest frankincense oil that has cured themselves of cancer. Now, if you know somebody, okay, who has done that, you have done that, I would like to know about it. Now, I know that many people have used frankincense resin and essential oil as part of a holistic treatment, and that may or may not be with or without allopathic treatment as well. And so what I can say is aromatherapy is excellent for people going through chemotherapy. It's going to help all kinds of things, anxiety and depression and sleep and all sorts of things. What will it do in terms of effect on the cancer? I don't know. Is it beneficial? Yes, absolutely. Are people using it as part of complementary medicine? Yes. Is it beneficial? Yes, absolutely. But where we have to be very careful is making the medical claims, frankincense oil cures cancer. If you put it on the tumor, you're going to cure it. That's where you're looking for trouble with the FDA. And it's probably not even true. So there's one exception to that that I think probably has some validity, and I'm waiting for somebody to actually show me before and after photographs, okay? I'm open to this, totally open to this, and I believe it's entirely possible, and that is skin cancer or precancerous cells. And there's a lot of information about this floating around also. So far, I have not seen anything fully documented start to finish, okay? Is it beneficial? I'm sure it's beneficial because frankincense is good for the skin. Will it actually cure squamous cell carcinoma? I have not yet seen that demonstrated, but if there is a type of cancer that frankincense essential oil has the potential to cure, I would say that's probably number one that has the greatest possibility. Why? Because you can put the frankincense oil directly on the cells in undiluted form, and it is biocompatible, and it's not going to, you know, burn your stomach. It's not going to poison your liver trying to get it into your blood circulation. You can put it directly on there. All right, so that's the end of my little story about frankincense. But one more final study, and this one I think is really remarkable. If you scroll all the way to the end, you'll see that there was a study done by some doctors in Australia who used very dilute applications of tea tree oil and water and also eucalyptus oil and water, and what they found was that they could wash the tumors that basically different types of tumors of the head and neck, when they develop, they burst out and they start to putrefy, and it's a terrible hardship, quality of life issue for the patient and the caregivers, because basically the patient has an extremely bad odor that fills the whole house, fills the whole hospital. Okay, and so they started washing the tumors with dilute applications of tea tree in one study, and then in this one with eucalyptus. And it was remarkable because what they found was that it not only had a dramatic effect in basically completely getting rid of the malodor and improving the quality of the patient's life, but they also found that it caused the tumor to heal up. Now, that's different than curing the cancer. What it did was it caused the skin to regenerate, and so the external putrefaction of the tumor on the outside was no longer visible and rotting and fetid and super infected and all of that. It basically got the tumor to grow new skin over it, close up, the infection went away, and so forth. That's different than curing the cancer. Okay, the treatment of the tumor is different than the cancer itself. The patient still died from the cancer, but the tumor was dramatically benefited. Okay, so I hope that you find all of this interesting. It's a much higher level of medical information about aromatherapy, but I wanted to share it because I do see tremendous potential for aromatherapy, both, you know, at the level of hospice care, cancer care, alternative complementary medicine for all types of serious illnesses. And I hope that I've given you a good basic overall view of some of the stuff that's happening in some of the cancer research. It's very important, and I do think, actually, that essential oils have tremendous possibilities as a new generation of medicines, both as antibiotics, since we are at the end of the antibiotic era, and also for cancer treatment as well. But we must make a very clear distinction between the type of aromatherapy that we are talking about practicing and that level of using essential oils medically. And that's where a lot of the controversy and misunderstandings and misuses are coming. People are attempting to do high-level medical treatments with essential oils without actually building a bridge of administering them properly to get them into the cells at the right dose. Okay, that's a lot of information and a lot of talking. Colleen, I'm going to turn it back to you, and let's take a look at some of the webcast questions here quickly. I'm running out of time, but I'll take one phone call or a couple of comments.
Okay. I will start with, I just want to let everyone know, if you want to ask David a question, please press 1 on your telephone keypad now. And otherwise, we have a question, a few that just came in.
Okay, I see these, and I think what I'd like to do is give a little bit more extended answer on the webcast file next week. How's that?
That's great. There was just a few more, too, that just came in.
Okay, if you want to go ahead and if you can post those quickly.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, so somebody says that there... Okay, so somebody says that there is one documented case study for skin cancer. Thank you. Good. I have suspected that if there's going to be one type of cancer that is curable with essential oils, that it would be frankincense for skin care. I mean, skin cancer. So, great. Now we have to get more specific about the particular species of frankincense oil and the particular levels of compounds that would have the best results and the various variations in skin cancers and extent of skin cancers and advanced, there's many, many factors. There's not just one thing called skin cancer. There's all sorts of individual variations. And as many variations as there are different oils as well. Okay, but that's good to know. So we have confirmation of one documented case study. Thank you for mentioning that. Could you maybe send it over so that we could actually look at that? You could send that to my email consulting box, or you could post it on the webcast for everybody. And... Oh, okay, Tisserand. You're quoting Tisserand here. Posted photos, treated. Okay, good. Thank you. That's good. So, yes, we would like to see solid proof of these things, okay? And then we don't have to wonder so much. Is it just rumors? Is it really working? And I believe that, so far what I've seen is that it makes perfect sense that frankincense could treat skin cancer. But again, I would have to say it's very individual because skin cancer can become very widespread. It can be very deep in the tissues. It can be very problematic. And I would probably qualify this and say, well, okay, maybe, earlier stage of it if treated aggressively as opposed to a later stage of it treated with maybe a contaminated oil or something like that. Okay.
We do have one caller, David.
Okay, great. Let's take that.
Okay. And it's going to Regina. You have the mic.
Hi. Thank you,
Hello,
Colleen.
Regina.
Thank you, Dave. Yes. Hello.
Yeah.
Hi. I don't know if you've come across this, but I don't even know where I read this, but in my studies in the past on herbal cures, specifically for skin cancer, and I don't know what type, I'm so sorry, it was recommended that you slice some raw garlic and tape it over the skin cancer site and leave it on until the sulfuric acid in the garlic actually dried it up and made the skin cancer peel off. I'm wondering if you have ever heard of such a thing, and if so, if you think that may be beneficial in certain types in early stages?
Well, that sounds like a folk medicine type of approach. And
okay.
I don't really know. I can't say one way or another. But you know what it reminded me of is I had a conversation with a dermatologist, and asked her, well, what's your opinion on people using alternative treatments? And she said, well, let me just warn you about the black salve, okay, because a lot of people use that. And that's it's a type of caustic application that supposedly burns it off, and that's why I'm reminded, because you're saying that the sulfuric acid will kind of burn it off. She says that what can happen with skin cancers is that you can burn the surface off, and it appears to be healed externally, but the cancer is still active internally underneath the skin. Now, I don't know if that's a particular case with garlic or not. I will have to plead ignorance in this particular case. I would also, just out of medical responsibility as a clinician, I would say if you are going to try something like that, you should have it monitored by a dermatologist, okay? If you want to try alternative treatments like that, you should always have it watched, okay? Don't do something and then just have it become inflamed and more irritable, or be doing something that might be spreading it, making it worse, or covering it up like that. So I don't really know. It's entirely possible that garlic might work. But on the other hand, I suspect that there may, you know, if there was a 100% cure for skin cancer with garlic, I think it might be a lot more well known. Another thing I will mention, however, that is getting a lot of attention is cannabis oil, and it appears that some people are also reporting beneficial things from that. But I would have to say, at least from my perspective, that most of this is hearsay, okay? Most of this are people saying, I heard about this from this person who heard about this from this person. And I'm very open. I believe that in some cases it's entirely possible, but I would really like to see a documented case, okay? And that documented case doesn't mean that it can be replicated by everybody either. Okay, so good question, good contribution. Unfortunately, I can't answer whether it's true or not. It sounds plausible, but I don't really know. But thank you.
Thank you, David.
Okay, so Colleen, I guess we're out of time. There's a few more really good comments here about frankincense and cancer. I will answer them on the webcast file for next week. And so, unfortunately, we'll have to sign off. Our time is over. And I just wish everybody a very good week. I hope you enjoyed this topic. It's complicated. But it's also very interesting, at least it is to me. I hope you found it interesting, and I hope that you continue with your olfactory explorations and your blending, and I hope to hear some wonderful testimonials from you next week. And so you can always go to the breakout groups and discuss what you learned and things that you are discovering and ask your questions also. And so with that, I'll just say have a wonderful week, and thank you, Colleen, again, and I'll turn it back to you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, David, from all of us, all of the participants listening now, the ones that will be listening in the future, all of us at the Shift Network. We will see you next week.